I'm gonna give you a little bit background, who I am and why, what is the reason I'm talking about this. Before that, I have a silly accent. I also make mistakes in English, but don't take that as an incompetence in the subject matter. It's just my incompetence in English, language. Anyways, so my background is I'm a PhD student in economics. I've studied economics for bachelor level and master's level back home. Which is Lithuania. And I also have an experience of 10 years working in a public policy institute, it's a think tank or non-governmental organization, which is Lithuanian Free Market Institute. I have even a picture of us. Oh, this is not all the people. We are institution which was established since we just got independent, which was a little bit less than 30 years ago. Lithuania became independent when Soviet Union, was brought down or collapsed basically in 1990, and Lithuania became independent country, which when it could decide its own matters, economic and other matters. And this institute was established as a way to trans a way to help. It was completely private initiative. It was not established as any governmental organization. It was private initiative by the chairperson, who's this woman here. Her name is Alana, and she thought that what we need is to understand what the market economy is about, what this capitalism everyone is talking is about. So in order that we could find a way how to transform our economy from centrally planned economy, which was at that time, I'm gonna give you the whole speech about that, into market economy. And so this institute, basically what we do is we craft all kinds of different proposals throughout of the years, how policies should be changed for the better. We also have educational programs, such as we teach students, we translate different books into Lithuanian language. Also, we're very active in media. The media is the way to influence politicians and policy decision makers. Right, so this is I've been I'm involved with them for 10 years, and this is where I learned most of the economic policy things that I know, and a lot of what I was saying is this is where I've learned about these things. Of course, I was not around. I mean, I was around during all this period because I was born in 1986, when and I was 4 years old when the Soviet Union collapsed. Right, so I don't really remember, or I could understand everything which was going on, but the things that I'm going to be talking about are from my experience working there. People who re were really active at that time, recalling all the economic events. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be giving you a story of Lithuania transitioning from centrally planned economy to market economy, with some interesting spins on what does it really mean to be a very small country. A small country, but what I mean by that is Lithuania is here. It's one of the Baltic states. These are three Baltic states: Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. We're the biggest Baltic state, which means that we are 3 million people. We have 3 million people. Latvia is about 2 million people. Estonia is 1 point something, 1.4 or 1.3. These countries historically are very interesting because they were all part of Soviet Union when it was alive. They were in Soviet Union for 50 years, right? After World War II, we became a part of Soviet Russia, basically. And our economies were going towards the direction of socialism, right? So the socialism was trying to be constructed for 50 years. And what it meant for Lithuania, oh, this is just before that. This is very interesting piece of document that I have here. What I write right here, I'm a fellow at the Mises Institute. This is a very interesting organization here. And just to give you a hint, what was the problem in 1990 when we just got independent? So Soviet Union collapsed. Everyone knew that. We don't want any of this socialism anymore, right? We want something different because that thing did not work. People were unhappy about it. Economic conditions were horrible, and it was just bad. And everybody knew that we need to change our policies into something else. But the problem is that all intelligentsia, all the academics are, of course, educated in universities which were Soviet type universities, where market economy, capitalism is a curse word. This is something which is bad, right? And people just have no idea what this other system that they think that they want is. So what was happening at that moment, this is a letter which was sent from the prime minister. She was female at that moment. Her name is Kazimiera Prunskienė. Anyways, prime minister of Lithuania at that moment in 1990. And it is a thank you note or a letter for the Mises Institute, this organization which is here across the street, for having six delegates of Lithuania's government to accepting them and teaching them about market economics and about how markets work, what should be done and what should not done, how to transition from centrally planned economy to market economy, right? So this is very interesting document. I quote, "We are also thankful for the knowledge we've got about the free market economy that has so old traditions in your state, and for those unforgettable minutes we've spent in Ludwig von Mises Institute, inimitable in its beauty, free spirit and ideas," right? So this is very interesting, and that really reflects what happening. People just wanted something else, and they just didn't know what it is, right? And the reason they didn't know what it is, because economy or economic system in Soviet Union looks very different from how it looks at the when we have more or less free market or market-based economy. So this is when we just got independent. This is the ending of 80s in Lithuania, and the one of the prerequisite of centrally planned economy is that when all the decisions what kind of products to produce and what not in market economy, they are more or less based on free enterprise, right? If I'm a businessman, I think that I have a very good idea of a product, and I gather resources that I need, you know, and I create a business, and if it's profitable, that means I'm producing something that market needs, right? So this is the basic idea. In Soviet Union, the difference is that more or less the decisions what to produce and where to produce are made from centrally planned way. So they were basically made in somewhere in Moscow. And that means that country is trying to work as a unit, and Moscow are making decisions where and what to produce. So, for example, in Lithuania, at the end of our occupation period, we call it, or the beginning of independence period, Lithuania accounted for about 0.3% of Soviet Union's territory, 1.3% of its population, right? But at the same time, what it meant is that we were producing, as a country, Moscow specialized us in certain things that the whole Russia needed at that moment, the whole Soviet Union. So we produce 22% of its electric welding apparatus, 11% of its metal cutting things, I don't even know what that is, 6.5% of its television sets, 8.8% of its altering current electric motors, and so it is unproportionately big amounts of these things are made somewhere in any of the Soviet Union country, and then all the other countries are being sent these things, right? So this is how centrally planned economy is being operated, right? The problem with that is, when you get independent, and Russia, of course, hates that, and it does not want to kind of have the same economic ties to Lithuania, that means that all factories that you have in the country, all capital is producing things that nobody really wants anymore. So that's the thing, because if you're independent, Russians are saying, okay, you want to be independent, so we are going to have a blockade on you. We're not going to import any of your goods. We're not going to send you any more fuel or anything like that. You're going to be isolated from Soviet Russia, right? And you are producing things that you cannot even anymore send and get any sums of money to Russia. Also, Western world, which we kind of wanted to go towards, don't want these things, because these things are usually in Soviet Union, the quality of the goods and of the goods and of course of the services too is very low when compared to the level of what was going on in Soviet countries. So the problem is that you are stuck with huge factories, which were centrally planned in order to distribute all goods to Soviet Union, that are becoming worthless because nobody really wants these goods anymore. So that's the economic conditions you find yourself in Lithuania or other Baltic states, and actually more or less all the countries which split from Soviet Union when it broke down. So that means, in a way, specialization in things that nobody really wants. So what happens then? Of course, these factories, in a way, have to go bankrupt, or this capital has to be turned into some other direction. So that is the biggest problem you find yourself when you are trying to turn from centrally planned economy to market economy, right? You really need to think then who really wants these things, because if you are not exporting them to Russia, nobody really wants them anymore. So and then of course your income is going to fall. So this is Lithuania's economy in Soviet Union. So this is one of the prerequisites. So centrally planned economy means that Moscow is planning what country is specializing in what things, right? Of course, there is a tight integration of Soviet Union economic and monetary system. I mean, you are just part of it. So you have ruble, which is Soviet Union's as currency. The other prerequisite is that state ownership and control of all the production. So Moscow is—it's not business, local businessmen who decided what to produce and what not. It is centrally planned decision. Now, total state control of prices, and this is also a very interesting thing to be discussing, and people just don't realize how it usually works, is that here prices are fluctuating, right? If you're a businessman, you have a service or a good to sell, what you do is like you think of a price, and if somebody wants to pay, that's going to be the price, right? So in Soviet Union, it's not the case. The prices were actually stamped on goods themselves. If you have a spoon from the times of Soviet Union, so you're gonna have a price stamped on it. I mean, it's stamped. You cannot erase it. It's gonna be a price which is gonna be the same price all over the Soviet Union, right? So this is the way that prices do not reflect any supply and the demand mechanisms. Prices are just centrally planned, right? The problem with prices, of course, is that, you know, goods usually were considered to be not so expensive, but the problem is that a lot of goods you just couldn't find. Some goods were just never around, not never available. Some shoes, clothing, there was a huge deficit of some goods. So that is also a problem. Also, Lithuania was heavily dependent on cheap energy products at that time, because in Russia, of course, have a lot of oil, and it produced that and it distributed to different states of Soviet Union in a very cheap fashion. The problem is when you get independent, Russia is not fulfilling with your needs of fuel anymore, and that means that you are really have problem of getting any fuel products. So that was also heavily dependent country, Lithuania, at that moment. As I told you, a constant deficit and constant shortage of certain goods, that was a very common thing, right? You know, and that was, for example, a picture. Хлеб is in Russia is bread, right? And these are just people waiting in lines. And this is just not in movies and not in a story. My mother still remembers that. And my mother hated Soviet Union so much because she had to wait in queues all the time. And it's not that you wait in queue and you get in and you buy everything you want. No, it's a separate queue for bread, separate queue for any other products, for shoes, or separate queue for meat if you want to buy it. And sometimes you wait in a queue for 3 hours and at the end of the line there's nothing left there. So that is a problem, and this is how the problem of shortage is going to be solved. You just stand there all day, and some people get these goods that they're waiting for, other people not. So that is a sign of a huge shortage of goods in Soviet Union. So this shortage was kind of hidden always. I mean, the prices were, Soviet Union were always saying, oh, the prices are low, and politicians were always bragging that, you know, everything is great, our prices are low, look at the United States, the prices are very high, you have high amounts of unemployment. The problem of that, yes, officially prices are low, when compared to the, you know, average wage of in a of a person. But the problem is you just could never get those goods, or you have to wait for them and queue for them for a lot of long periods of time. And also the mentality of people at that moment, and they were in a way brainwashed for 50 years. And the market, prices, capitalism, it was a curse word, right? It was something which is intrinsically bad. And my mother would tell me stories about that, that every time before you're watching any kind of movie in a theater, so right now what you have commercials, right? Before in Soviet Union times, you also had commercials, but they were propaganda kind of commercials. So my mother would tell me how she was literally brainwashed. You know, she was like, she was living in Soviet Union times. I mean, she was, you know, she didn't have a very good life, but she was even more afraid of capitalism of America, because every time you go to a movie or something like that, you would have this, okay, in Soviet Union times, we are producing more and more things every year. So this is this, you know, statistical propaganda. Every time more cows are going to be slaughtered, more milk is going to be produced, more of everything, right? The problem is that people didn't feel that in their lives, but officially every 5 years there is increased production of everything. So that's the state propaganda. And then next to that, they show the videos of Great Depression in the United States, how horrible it is. Everyone is unemployed. People are looking for jobs. They cannot provide for their families and stuff. So this is the kind of contrast they were trying to create, that capitalism leads to horrible, bad things, unemployment, people starving, and Soviet Union type socialism, which basically means low prices, more production every year, and stuff like that. You have a question, yeah?
I don't have a question. I want to help you. You just said about women and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also from Ukraine.
Yeah.
The parts of the Soviet Union. The most important thing, in my opinion, you need to say that in Soviet Union you couldn't be unemployed.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's one thing. Yeah, so that's correct. Another thing about unemployment, the best story that I have is of my mom telling me those. She hated that system, and she has all kind of stories. So first of all, yes, every time you finish any kind of education, you were ascribed a job. You say, okay, you finished, that means you cannot be unemployed. You go to this factory and work there. My mother was trained in bio. She was a biochemist, and she still is. So she has education in, you know, this biological molecular things. I don't really understand it. So anyways, and so she finished that, and she was sent to a factory which were producing some kind of military micro schemes or something like that. And her education has nothing to do with what was the thing and the issue at her job. So what she would do is just like, nobody really wanted me in this factory. She was sent there, but she was not really needed there. So what she would do is she would just go somewhere in a little room and she would sleep there the whole day. She was also pregnant at that time, and she was like, I was just tired all the time, and I would just go there and sleep, and nobody really cared about that, really. So officially she has a job, but you can see what is the level of productivity or of efficiency. Nobody really cares about that. I mean, as long as officially everyone has a job, everyone is unemployed, the chief, you know, of this factory doesn't really cares, because his job is not making profits, right? His job is just like, you know, to run the factory. If there's a person who's sleeping and not complaining, that's fine with me. It's fine. It's just like, you know, on paper she has a job, we're producing micro schemes, everything is great. So this is another thing. When you know, sometimes people say profit motive is bad, is evil, but when you don't have it, things like that happen. Anyways, there's a huge discussion. Okay, so this is where I probably should end discussing how it was before we got independent, and how Lithuanian economy, which was part of Soviet Union, looked like. Now we get independent, 1990. Russia, of course, tries to blockade us in many ways. They're not importing our goods anymore. Some, yes, but a lot of the production had to be halted. And of course, during all the revolutions, all the transition periods, there is a certain period of time when things get worse, right? And that's the period which you have to survive. And I would think that the biggest part of this period were about the beginning of 5-6 years of our independence. then the problem is that, of course, as I told you, all the factories, all the production facilities, they suddenly are worthless because these products, nobody needs these products anymore. So they have to be shut down. There's huge unemployment, huge shortage of resources. The economic conditions of the country even worsen for a certain period of time. There is some statistics which I found that from the period of 1989 to 1993, Lithuania's GDP fell by about 60 to 70%. I mean, so that's huge. United States, when there is a recession, minus 3%, everyone is, so imagine 60. I mean, that's just every, so goods and services are the huge shortage of them, and people just finding some ways how to survive. The other thing is that prices were let go, right? That prime minister who came to United States, one of the ideas she got is that you have to liberalize the prices. They should not be regulated anymore. And what happened, since they were suppressed and the prices at that time did not really represent any kind of production costs, they skyrocketed. Right, the price went up, and it went up very highly. Also, there are some other issues of a lot of rubles coming into since at that time, from 1990 to 1993, the official currency were still rubles because we could not have that quickly the monetary reform. And there were huge inflows of rubles into Lithuania because a lot of people just realized that what we have in these factories are precious metals, and they were trying to buy these precious metals and sell them somewhere else abroad, right? So there was a huge inflow of currency, prices were being let go, and there was even hyperinflation. 1992, inflation rate in Lithuania is 1,163%, which is tenfold increase in prices, right? So huge inflation, production facilities are gone, all the capital is being depreciated, basically. Then we also understood that this cannot continue, and what we need to do is we do not want to centrally plan our economy anymore, so we should privatize things. The problem is with privatization is when you do that on the very shaky grounds not only economically but also politically, because you know there's a new country, the rule of law is still not there, public institutions are very weak, and of course any kind of deals which a government trying to make, for example privatization, they're going to be not very nice. So privatization was pretty quick, but the problem with it was there are a lot of shady deals and a lot of corruption involved. So people who were well off at those times where you really know whom to give a little bit of money, and then they could privatize factories for a very, very low amount of money. And people just did not understand what's going on, and a lot of people who were, in a way, not good businessmen, a lot of them were just crooks. So they got a lot of capital, a lot of things which were in the ownership of government, because because before that there was no private property, right? All the factories, everything is owned by the government. So privatization process was quite quick, but it was also quite corrupt. And there is a huge debate whether we should have waited for a little bit longer to privatize things. And then when we already have some more better public institutions, and maybe then would have been less corruption. Others say, well, it doesn't really matter. You just put that out there. It doesn't matter who gets it, as long as it's in private hands, ruled by profit motive. It's better than it's being run by the government. So that's a huge debate which is still going on. If we should have done that by it so quickly. The problem is that the more government has those things, the more difficult for them, for government it is usually to let it go. And there are examples of other countries which delayed privatization, but they never privatized things. Anyways, as I said, immense depreciation and loss of capital, huge drop in GDP. So this is the beginning, and this is really, really rough period. There was increase in criminal activities in the country. So that was really that was a huge hit, because people were in the beginning of independence, people were in euphoria. They said, oh, now we're going to have a country, we're going to lead it, we're going to run it the way it should be run, and everything is going to be great. And then you fall into this hole and ground, an economical hole, basically. Now, after that, the period of, I'm going to give you the five periods of an independence and tell you what they are basically about. 94 to 1998, things were turning a little bit for the better. For one thing which we did is we introduced our own currency, which is called litas. And one very interesting thing that Lithuanians did, and I'm sure what it was also not without the help of, you know, more kind of classical liberal institutions in the United States in the way helping us with our reforms. What we did is say, okay, so we, if you have currency, which is going to be still government-run currency, you need to have a central bank. So what kind of central bank are we going to have? The problem is that nobody really trusted. That is actually, especially after the huge inflation periods of 1992, nobody trusts money and nobody trusts any government institution to run money. Because they think if we're going to establish a central bank, they're just going to print money and there's going to be huge inflation. So we don't want that. So what we did is we established a central bank, but we introduced a system which is called the currency board system. Currency board system basically means that the central bank does not have monetary power to print money, as much money as it wants. That means that we have fiat money, which is paper money, circulating in the currency, but every piece of paper or every banknote of the issued by the central bank is covered by 100 reserves, 100% reserves. And these reserves were at the beginning gold and United States dollars. Most of what it was United States dollars. So basically what we said, we're pegging our currency and we're mandating the central bank to have 100% reserves of United States dollars for every banknote which is being issued. So that means that central bank cannot just print money if it doesn't have the equivalent amount of US dollars on its balance sheet. So that basically means that central bank ties our hand in printing money. All it can do, it serves as a currency exchange. If people are importing US dollars from somewhere, they can change that into litas, and that's it. And central banks does not make any kind of decisions of what is the money supply in the country. It is being regulated naturally by the inflows and outflows of the currency, which is the reserve currency. At that moment, it was US dollar. In 2002, we changed that into euros because we wanted to get into European Union. So that was actually a pretty smart decision, because then all fears of inflation went down very quickly. In a year or so, interest rate went down rapidly. Inflation rate went down rapidly. In 1 year, it went from 1,000 something to 5% or so. Because people were trusting this central bank doing that, and they knew that central bank cannot just print money and create inflation. And that was very, very important reform for Lithuania. And even now, the central bank, which was really opposed that at that moment, because they wanted to have their economic power, they really think that this is one of the best reforms in Lithuania when we transitioned from centrally planned to the market economy. And privatization worked in a way that already 70% of working force was already employed in the private sector, which was a huge transition in like 5 or 6 years. Things like trade companies, banks, most of the production companies were just privatized. So this is the period where already economy is kind of already starting to grow, because everything, all the things collapsed, and then it's okay, so what kind of products we can produce, how can we go on, and this is the period of economic growth already. And this is a symbolic value. This is a very famous politician of Lithuania, it doesn't matter, but the first McDonald's in Lithuania was opened in 1995. So this is the interesting fact, which is kind of correlates with my story, which I'm saying this is the period of more economic growth. Anyways, after that, what happened? At that moment, we were still quite dependent on the Russian economy for importing a lot of things, and also because Russians realized, okay, there's no need for to have this blockade anymore. They're not gonna come back and you know, asking to let them in into Soviet Union. That's gone. That train has passed, right? So they will already started trading more with Russia, and still about 70 or so percent of imports and exports was going out of and in so-called NVS countries or Russia and its neighboring neighboring, basically, Eastern countries, right? The problem is, 1998 to 2003, Russia was hit by the huge financial crisis. There are different reasons for that. One of them is, a lot of people say it was an oil problem because there was a crash in oil prices and Russian economy was very dependent on the on oil, and therefore Russia's economy was really going down. And since we were exporting a lot to Russia, we were also hit a lot. Right. So what happened then is that we had huge budget crisis in Lithuania, a huge crisis of economy, and unemployment was going up. And that is also very interesting that, okay, so we are economy, which is in transition. We cannot print our way out of this. We don't have the ability to print because we're going to create inflation. We also do not have this a lot of borrowing power, because if we go to international markets, nobody really wants to borrow us money because nobody really knows this country, where it's from or whatever. They don't trust the country. So what you have to do in these conditions, you have to find ways how to get out of it. So at that moment, it was crisis which led to opportunity to reorient our country from exports to Russia and think about exports to the Western world. And really, in 5 years, the export orientation changed quite rapidly. Before, you know, Russian crisis is about 70% going to the east. After that, I say, okay, this market is no good anymore. What we have to do is we have to think about the quality of our products to increase it and maybe try to export more to the west, to Poland, to Germany, to France, to United Kingdom. I mean, Western world, even United States. And this is the period, and this is a lesson from that, is when crisis hit. If you cannot find easy ways out, how to just borrow your money out of it, or print your way out of it, what you do is really start to think as a country what should be the way for you to regain your economic growth. And for that period was really a reorientation of production and export towards the West by gradually increasing the quality of the products of Lithuania. So that was really a difficult period, but at the same time a big opportunity for Lithuania. Next is 2003 and 2008. One of the things that Lithuanians really wanted to do since they got independent, because when you live next to a huge country, which is in many ways not your friend, but enemy, in some ways your friend, but also your enemy, is that you really, Lithuania tried to get into all our international organizations it could. So since the independence, we tried to get our way into European Union. We try to get into NATO, we try to get into United Nations and organizations that would be our allies in case something bad happened, right? So, and that this period from 2003 to 2008 is really the period when we already got admitted to a lot of them. So in 2004, we got admitted into European Union and into NATO, which was a huge deal for us. It was very, very big, because we had to work a lot for it, change our economy, change our laws, change a lot of it in order to get admitted to European Union. There are very good and bad sides to European Union. I mean, good things is that once you're in European Union, you don't have any, you can trade very easily with all the other European Union countries. There are no tariffs, qualitative or quantitative tariffs. There are no taxes. Trade is as easy as it is between the different states in the United States. So that's a good thing, because Lithuania is very, since it's very small, it has to focus on some things which it is good at, and also import and export everything else. So that's how small economies work. Right. So that is a good thing. Also, another good thing, since we got into European Union and all the foreign investors suddenly started to realize that this is maybe a country which we interesting from the investment point of view, a lot of financial flows of investment were started to flow into Lithuania, because they thought, okay, so this is already a market economy, more or less. Institutions of government are Western. There's a rule of law, protection of property rights. That means we should invest in Lithuania. A lot of investment were starting to go to Lithuania. The problem with all of this, that of course the economy started to grow because of exports, because of inflow of foreign direct investment. Also, Swedish or Scandinavian banks were established in the country, which also wanted to increase lending. in these countries. The problem of that is that there was economic boom basically happened, and as we now know it, it was economic bubble in a way. There are huge inflows of financial inflows, which basically meant that people economic growth was happening, but it was not really sustainable. So what happened, we had credit and real estate bubble, which burst in 2008 and 2009. So this was a period of very huge economic growth, which spurred by good factors, which is just increase in productivity, more trade, but also some unsustainable factors, which are inflows of financial flows from commercial banks in Scandinavia, also inflows of financial flows from other sources. So what happened then? 2008. 2008, Lithuania's GDP crashed. It was minus 15, and that is when the credit bubble burst, and our economy kind of, I wouldn't say collapsed, but it was very difficult. But it was also difficult all over the Europe, or even in all the different countries of the world. So. And since then, we slowly picked up the pieces and tried to move on. 2009 it was bad, 2010 pretty bad, 11 better. And since then, our economy picked up and started to grow. Right now, we are in the period of quite high economic growth. We are the country which is one of the fastest growing countries in the whole Europe. And one of the things that I would like to finish this period with is, I think one of the interesting factors in this whole economic story is that as a small country, Lithuania is a very small country. Nobody knows where it is. Nobody cares really about it. But it gives some bad things from the economic point of view, because it's really kind of sometimes difficult to attract investment. Because, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere and things like that. But at the same time, it gives you a certain mentality which helps. Right now is the period where we really are focusing on the competitiveness of the country. Even social democrats in our country or any other left-leaning parties, which are usually not for investment, they're more for redistribution, they care about business conditions and about investment conditions, because they know that as a small country, if you are not providing favorable business conditions, no business is gonna stay, or even no business is gonna invest from abroad in your country. So even left-leaning parties are kind of thinking about how to increase foreign investment, because foreign investment is very important for the productivity growth of the country. We are always for tax competition in European Union. There are some countries of European Union who said, okay, we should not have this tax competition, like French or sometimes German say. We should make profit tax the same in all the European Union. And Baltic states, Lithuania including them, are always against that, because they think, well, no, because there are good reasons why people invest in Germany. It's a good country, big market, rule of law, strong institutions, low corruption, etc. We don't have some of these things. I mean, we are still lagging behind, but what we could offer them are favorable business conditions of lower taxes, lower, less red tape and things like that. So as a small country competing between other countries, you really think about what could be the sources of your productivity, of your growth, of your competitiveness in the world. And that's in a way that works. Lithuania, in this doing business index, which is created what's the organization? The World Bank, right? So Lithuania ranks in the 14th place in the world according to the business conditions in this index, which is, I mean, it's not the highest you could do, but it's still high, and it's also high when you compare that, 15 years ago it was already, it was not already, but it was very comparatively and significantly lower in this rank. Yeah, so this is the story of Lithuania transitioning from the centrally planned economy towards market economy. Of course, I'm not saying it's a fairy tale. There are problems. I can tell you a lot of those, but still, for me, this is the story where in not that many years, in 30 years, we really transitioned a lot, and the life of people really changed. And I see that in my own family. My parents are kind of, you know, I wouldn't say like intellectual, they're educated, should be like middle class in the country, but they were really, really struggling in the beginning of the independence, because the people who did who had a lot of money were those who knew how to work the system. And this is what happens in transition periods. Those people who are, you know, crooks, know how to steal, know how to, you know, do away with corruption and things. These were people who did well. Like people who are not in a way entrepreneurial in this sense did not do very well. And our family really struggled, especially we have a family of four kids, and that was quite difficult in the beginning. And my mother was always very struggling with that, and she hated it that she never had money to buy things that she wanted to buy for her kids. And in the 20 whatever years, life just completely changed. We consider ourselves to be a middle class family, and we can afford things. I mean, car, to own a house, or a house, a flat, or whatever, and travel sometimes and things like that, which were unimaginable in 20 years ago. So that really is the story of, I would say, more or less economic success. Of course, there are things that could be done better, but that's what we are working on in you know, institutions of government, and also private organizations such as Lithuanian Free Market Institute. So thank you very much for your attention. I'll be happy to answer any of your questions if you have any. Thank you. You mean back in Soviet Union? Well, this is a huge. This is a very interesting question you have. It has a big history, because the premise of socialized systems is what socialism really hates. One of the things that it hates is profit motive, right? Because they think that profit is exploitation, and profit is trying to work for profit is evil. So, but the other thing is that we know that human nature has something to do that, you know, if you need some kind of motive in order to get up in the morning and do stuff, right? In capitalist systems, it is profit motive for you to create products. Also, it's a creation motive. The problem, if you don't have profit motive in a in a socialist system, you have to replace it with something. To my understanding, one of the best, from the ideological point of view, profit motive should have been replaced with high morale of people. Right? You are not working because you want to earn a lot of money. You are working because you are creating great things, or that you have high morale, and you know that work is great, and that you are contributing for your country, and that should be your not only like public and not only stated motivation, but also very close and private motivation of yours. The problem with that is that it did not work. That was an assumption, I think, in socialized system, that people will strive, work, and create things just because there's this high morale of people, but it never really happened. Yeah, actually, what happened was vice versa, because you work in a factory, for example, right? And you know that you are not doing very well, and this factory is producing something. The best jobs were, for example, in meat factories. Just because you know that if you steal a little bit and you go home with a little bit of meat or something like that, you will do well for your family, right? So then your motivation is not to work hard, to create something, to earn from it and have money to pay things and buy things for your family. Your motivation becomes, because it doesn't really matter if you work hard or not hard, you're gonna get the same. Your income is gonna be the same, your wage is gonna be the same. So for you to excel your economic condition is to basically steal from the government. And that is also very interesting, that in the mentality of people, there are still, since they were brought up in Soviet Union times, a lot of people, I mean, I was not brought up, but I'm relatively young when compared to the average in the country. A lot of it is that stealing from government is not considered to be bad because you are really stealing from the enemy, right? Because the government is Soviet Russia and it has occupied our country. Therefore, stealing from them is not a bad thing. So, all in all, what I wanted to say is that it is really difficult to keep this high morale of people when they know if they're gonna work or not work, they're not gonna increase their economic situation. And the best way how you can provide with your family is just to find bad ways how to get things. And this is really the reason why a lot of people say that really one of the big damages of Soviet Union in Lithuania was not only changed in bad economic conditions, but it's a change in the morality of people, that the morality was gone. I mean, if you knew how to steal well and not to be caught, you were, in a way, you are in the elites, and that's not really the kind of moral system you want to have in a society.
Yeah. I want to correct you a little bit.
Okay.
But you say, like, steal from the government.
Yeah.
As you told before, like the Soviet Union propaganda, yeah?
Right.
And it's always said that, for example, in a capitalist system, you go to the factory which owned a bad guy who earned a lot of money, or the broker.
Right, right.
Yeah, capitalists.
Right.
Damn capitalists.
Yes. Horrible people.
And in Soviet Union, they decide to say that if you go, for example, when you finish your education,
right,
and go to the factory, you have a piece of this factory. You also own this factory.
Sure.
So what they say is like, you're also part of the huge mechanism,
right,
which produces steel,
right,
for example.
I agree with
and
this so far.
Some people understand it. I'm not stealing, I just get my stuff from the work. Why not?
Oh. My share.
Yeah.
Okay, but okay, so this is how you rationalize it, but everybody knew that because there were guards next to the entrance or an exit of the factory, and people would have to hide it. They would literally put sausages in their shoes and everywhere, and they steal vodka bottles and stuff like that. So they knew they were doing something wrong, right? Because there were guards, and then everybody knew they're stealing. It's just like how much you can, because if you steal too much, the factory is not really producing anything, and then the central planner is not really happy. So there were guards sitting next to the doors. I mean, I know what you mean by saying, okay, so you should not steal because we all own this factory, but it didn't cut into mentality of people. I don't own anything here. I just come here, I work, and I go home, and I don't do very well. So how should I increase my well-being? I just steal. And so that was that didn't really help. The morality question in it all, the way it was supposed to work, it was like, oh, we are all creating a better society of greatness, of economic growth and stuff like that. That did not work in on the individual level of motivating people. It was a complete failure, I think. And that was one of the systematic failures of why the system could not really work, I think. Yeah.
There's like a growing kind of social movement in the US right now, particularly led by Bernie Sanders.
Right.
And he says a lot of times that we need to be more like Denmark. Can you explain kind of like the similarities and differences between like how Denmark is structured and how the United States?
I don't know if you've noticed this. This is going to be part of my answer to this. You see this? So this is the business. This is the index of how favorable business conditions are in the country, and when we think about Denmark being a socialist country or Sweden, I mean, it's Scandinavia, there are many instances where politicians of these countries saying don't say that we are, because we are not. It's a bad reputation for them. So I have a different speech about socialism of Scandinavian countries, but yes, Scandinavian countries are, in a way, we can call them, I mean, they're not so socialist in the sense that factors of production are in public hands. I mean, this is what socialism is. I don't know if Cortes or Sanders mean that when they say socialism. They call democratic socialism, but Soviet Union was also democratic socialism. So I don't know what they really mean by that. But if we think theoretically, socialism means the means of production in the hands of government, which is not in any way the case in Scandinavian countries. Scandinavian countries have certain amount of things that people tend to think they're closer to socialism or socially oriented systems. One of them is redistribution of our government, the public spending as a percentage of GDP, which tends to be higher in Scandinavian countries for good or bad reasons. So that is one thing. The other thing is the labor code, which is pretty strict in Scandinavian countries. And strict not only as a labor code as such, but also because of the trade unions, which have a very big part role in the labor market. And also some taxes are quite high, not necessarily profit tax, but income tax. They have progressive system and it goes to a high percentage. But also recently, Scandinavian countries were lowering actually that because they knew that they are hurting there. So this is the only thing that I can think of. All the other things, if we think about regulation, if we think about taxation of profits, if we think about all the other systems, they are actually more pro market and free market than Germany or than France. If we think about business conditions, how easy it is to open a company and operate it, they are number three in the world according to the World Bank, which is not a libertarian organization, right? So that tells me something, that from the point of view of how heavily businesses are regulated and taxed, Scandinavian countries are probably not those where Sanders would want to go, right? So I think it's in some ways it's a huge myth. Also, another thing which I would add, Scandinavian countries are rich not because of this democratic socialism programs that they have during the last 50 years. Scandinavia, the whole region was really the most pro-market region free market region in the world, beginning in 1850s and ending in 1950s. All the trade unions, all the regulation, all the taxation and redistribution happened after 1950s. But at that moment, they already were very, very rich countries. And the reason for that is that they had good policies, which were market-oriented policies and more market-oriented policies than anywhere else in the world. So basically, one of the other answers that I would give, they are in a way capitalizing on the wealth that was created not in democratic socialism, but which were created by the market for the 100 years before democratic socialism. So that is another thing. But, you know, people just don't go more than 50 years. People just don't think 5 years ago what happened. So that's the economists are just really, really bad at history, economic history. That's another thing. And also, you know, people like Bernie Sanders. He already forgot what he told about Venezuela and other countries. Have you seen this video of him talking about how great it is and I've been to recently to Russia, how great it was. Have you seen this? No? There was a YouTube video who was commenting on Cuba and Russia and how great it is because he's visited them and stuff like that. And he's just man. Anyways.
So why do you think we have such great historical examples of how miserably socialistic systems fail? Why is socialistic ideas becoming so popular, particularly in the United States? So why do you think, especially among the young generation, so why do you think the young generation of Americans are so captivated and intrigued and, you know, they favor socialism? There have been a lot of studies done that, you know, a lot of the young generation, like 20-something,
they all
favor socialistic system. Is it because they just don't know what it is? And they, like you said, Lithuania, people knew that socialism was bad. They wanted something new. They didn't.
Yeah.
They wanted something different. So
yes.
Maybe it's the same here because we have close to free market or mixed economy, and people think that there is a different system. They don't really know much about it, and they think it may be better.
Oh, I think there are many different reasons for that, and there could be whole another speech about this. But I could pinpoint several things. First of all, I don't really think they actually know what they're talking about, because they're talking about that and they're tweeting that using Facebook, using their iPhone, sitting in Starbucks or something, and just like. I mean, so this is just insane. I mean, they have no idea what kind of results the policies that they mean would bring. So that's one thing. I think they're just clueless what it actually means economically, right? So it's just ignorance, I think. So that's one thing. But you cannot explain everything with ignorance. Another reason I think that the idea of socialism is very compelling. It's just very attractive, right? Especially if you're a well-meaning, maybe kind of goofy human being. It sounds very great. I mean, we're just gonna help each other on the systematic level. We should not trust in other people helping me personally. We should redistribute people, redistribute resources, give them things that they really need by taking from people which are very rich and probably they got their riches from bad sources and by exploiting others. I mean, it's just on paper it sounds great because it means help and wellness on the systematic level of the country. So I think it sounds great. It's just a very horrible idea because it does not work, because it creates incentives which in the long term lead to starvation. So I think it's the idea and the way it sounds, it's very compelling, and people just don't know really what it actually is. So I think that the third reason is that I don't know. I sometimes feel that people are just, especially young people, and I still consider myself to be a young person. They're lacking some kind of purpose in their life. Sometimes I think there's mentality of this that all the system that they work in or that I am, they all hate me. My parents kind of don't understand what I'm doing. If I get a job, my employer hates me. They don't really find themselves. And a lot of people say I have no skills. I finished university, but I cannot really find a job anywhere. They kind of feel rejected in many ways. And I think they're kind of disillusioned personally about how much they're useful for the system that they are in right now. And they think, okay, so what we live is capitalism, and that doesn't really work, so we need something else. So, and they're trying, as young people, also reinventing everything from new. So they kind of think that, okay, we need some systematic tectonic break and change in the way we are, in the economic and social system. So I think they kind of feel a little bit kind of alienated. In this respect, a lot of it is just bad upbringing, I think. But so that's the other thing why the socialism is so attractive among young people. And also, young people are just rebels, right? Socialists were always rebels in a way. They were saying, "Oh, we're gonna bring everything down. We are gonna create new system. Where everything is great." It's just they're trying to be rebels, but I think in a very destructive causes in ways. So that would be my 3 cents in it, but you know, I'm sure there are studies written about it.
My understanding of me also grew up in the Soviet Union, from what I see people and I talk to people who think that socialism is a good idea, like you said, these are a little bit goofy people.
Yeah.
I call them these people who want to free ride on others.
Oh, so it's pretty goofy.
Usually they view socialism this guy likes to work hard, but yeah. I don't. But
right.
In socialism, everything gets split evenly. So that's what I find who likes. I think if you want to think about the same education system, I offer my big, class a lot of my students today. I'm very happy to see that. Instead of assigning everybody a grade, I have 262 students. Based on their effort, I just calculate the class average and give everybody, whatever the class average is, a C or something like that. I'm sure that a lot of them will be very unhappy about that. But that essentially
not only unhappy if you try it, not only that, if you did that and you repeat this test, so you will see that the average will go down, right? Because the students who are studying a lot, they will say, why should I study?
Right. Efforts will go down eventually. Yeah. They're
not gonna.
Bonus points.
Yeah.
A plus right now. If I give them a C, they're not gonna work hard.
So that's this is exactly the question about mentality, right? So in socialist system, say no matter everyone gets the average, right? But you still should study and work very hard. Well, yes, on the paper, yes. But what is the incentive for me to study one more night if I'm just gonna get the average? So the best performers are just demotivated.
Yeah. From what I communicated, I talked to people here who support socialistic idea, usually these are people who are like slackers, and they think they view this as a, you know, way to free ride on others.
But is that really this person who's in Starbucks tweeting about how great the Cortez is, Sanders is it? Aren't, I think a lot of them are not just one. I knew one Apple phone or whatever. That's why I do. I think there's more like intrinsic. I mean, a lot. Some of them probably is. They just say, oh, I hate rich people. But a lot of youth, they're kind of the enthusiastic and very idealistic, but in very strange ways. I don't think it's only kind of envy and being having grudge against rich people. I think there's something more to it, which scares me too. I mean, this
side. Some of them believe it's like altruistic because they see that they're like huge billionaires, you know, like with like say most of the world's wealth, and they're like, well, there's a bunch of poor people.
Yeah.
So you can like take all that money.
Yeah, I mean, and also the other thing is the way to address it is, it's of course, they all say that what we live right now in is capitalism, right? But it's not. I mean, in many ways, how can you call capitalism if you know 40% of GDP is being redistributed through government? I mean, it's not pure capitalism, and you have a lot of corporatism where companies are really being subsidized and regulated in the ways that create bad incentives for them. So a lot of things are not good. So I think that this is the other thing that they think, okay, so we live in pure capitalism. They see problems happening, and I don't ignore them. Of course, there are problems. But they say, okay, we need something else. They do not realize that really maybe these problems which we are having right now are maybe also caused by interventions or by subsidies or by regulation and things like that. Yeah.
So how typical would you say the situation economically in Lithuania was to other post-Soviet states such as Poland or Ukraine or East Germany, etc.?
How typical?
Pretty similar.
I would think it's, I mean, there are of course differences because different countries of Eastern and Central Europe were connected to Soviet Union system in different ways. Some of them were more free to have the economic policy. Some of them they were less free. Lithuania was in the region where it was more controlled by Moscow. But the general idea of what are the problems when you get away from the Soviet system, these are very similar problems. It is, especially among Baltic states. I mean, it's almost the same. Yeah.
In your opinion, do you think that like a pure capitalist free market system could work?
Excuse me, can you repeat?
Do you think that like a pure capitalist free market system could work 100%?
Yeah, it depends what you mean by pure capitalist, because there are so many definitions. Okay, so what's the closest country you can? So, Singapore, right, or Hong Kong? It's a very, very tiny, small places. It works pretty well there. I mean, they have problems, but they in the economic freedom indices, they are on top, the number one, number two, and it works well there, I think. So, but it's not pure. You have government there. You have some taxation, some regulation. So you don't have a place because it's a mental construct. I mean, we can think of a pure capitalistic society, but then again it depends where you go, because this is where you begin. Because if you're minarchist, you think, okay, so we still need government. So the usually even the like hardcore conservatives, like if you listen to Crowder or something like that, what he would say that we still need government for police, courts, military, you know, things like that, protection of property rights in general sense, right? But that's not the whole spectrum. There are people and theorists who think, okay, maybe we should not yet have government at all. Why should we trust government in with our safety, right? Why should we trust government in running our police or our courts, right? So so to some people, pure capitalism would mean even getting rid of government in those fields. So, but this is already becomes a very hypothetical discussion, which is fun if you're kind of drunk or whatever. But when it comes to really thinking about the real life and policies, where should we go as a country, to what direction, these discussions are really not very useful to my understanding. So I think I don't know if pure capitalism would work, but I think more capitalism would work. So this is what I would think.
Capital definitely works better. rather than socialism things. Like if you compare the two systems, and then private ownership is much better than, you know, state ownership. So, and these countries like Soviet Union is a great example that when you have state ownership or like shared ownership, which means nobody owns it, then it changes the mentality of people, and then you don't treat it as your own property, right? So you go to this publicly owned, you know, apartment in Soviet Union, and then people go to the bathroom there. You would not go in the bathroom in your hallway, right? If you owned it.
Right.
You probably know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
So you go like public elevators, you know, and this bench is unbelievable. Just people relieve themselves. But nobody would relieve themselves in the middle of their living room. Because you own it, so you feel like it's yours. But this would happen in a... Like, if it's owned by the state, it means it's owned by nobody. And then I think this changes the whole mentality how you treat things. And that's the fundamental problem of the socialism. And it's the principle of socialism that it's owned by the state. And then it changes the whole incentive structure and system. So I think that's... And then, like, we don't know whether pure capitalism will work, but definitely it works a lot better than socialism.
And I would just add, it's such a pity that actually if you open like a textbook of undergrad economics, the discussion of ownership and the importance of it is not really there. I mean, you start from microeconomics, macroeconomics, the ownership idea, which I think is one of the most important economics, it's just missing, which is interesting because they treat it as a political question, which really is not a political question. It's actually the way ownership is being determined really affects the economic results of the system. So it's not only a political question, it's an economical question.